Rare Mind Talks, the podcast where we explore how data, technology, and leadership can transform the lives of people living with rare diseases. Today's guest is Pat Furlong. Pat is the founding president and CEO of Parent Project Muscular Dystrophy, PPMD, the largest nonprofit in the US focused entirely on Duchenne muscular dystrophy. She's a powerful advocate, a system changer, and a pioneer in putting patients at the center of science and policy. Pat, it's an honor to have you with us. Thank you very much for accepting the invite.
Andre, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm so grateful to you for inviting me.
Thank you very much. And Pat, let's start from the beginning. And I'd love to start with your personal story. What led you to start PPMD, and how did you turn your personal loss into a movement for true change?
Well, a long time ago, in 1994, my two boys were diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. It was a day that I don't think I'll ever remember. I remember the room and the doctor and what that doctor was wearing when he said to me, "Your two boys have Duchenne muscular dystrophy." And I said, like any parent would, "So where do we go for treatment, and what do we do next?" And he looked at me and said, "There's nothing to do. They will soon lose their ability to walk. They will, after that, lose their ability to lift their arms, and they will die in their teens." When I asked him, "Surely there's something you can do," he just looked at me and said, "No, there isn't any hope here, and there is no help to give you." So I came home, and you can imagine the grief that sort of rushes over you. And Duchenne then started to infiltrate every single sentence and every paragraph and every home in every place in my home. And I had an early career in nursing where I was in a whole organ transplant and renal dialysis and ICU and CCU. And I couldn't recall a time when I ever said to a patient, "There isn't anything to hope for here." So it took some time, I must say, to think through the grief. And then you think, well, what could change this? What could we do? And then I found myself with making a long list of questions. And they sort of boil down to a couple, like, what do we know about this disease? Why isn't there any hope? What do we know about the biology or pathology of this disease? Well, surely we know something. By this time, the gene was cloned and a protein product identified. So we had two pieces of information, but not much more. And then I wondered, where is the money coming from? Who is spending money on this? And then if they are spending money, where is that money going and what's happening there? And is it a coordinated effort? And then I ask in my list of questions, so what does the federal government, because in the United States, we have the National Institutes of Health. It is suggested to be the most robust research enterprise in the world. So what are they doing? What are they thinking about? And the primary problem for me was I didn't want any parent to receive that news. I was and continue to be in medicine. And I had some thoughts about this, and I knew the medical community. I knew people in the medical community, and I wondered, how does it feel to be a parent without those resources, without the ability to know who to call to get a different opinion? So with that, I started to search around about those questions. Who's here? What are they doing? Where's the money? What's the policy? And at the time in the United States government, there was established the Office of Rare Disease. I went to Washington, D.C., met with Dr. Steve Groft at the Office of Rare Disease, and he said to me, "Let's begin together." And as soon as you get one person that says that, then you know you're on a path forward.
Now, thank you very much for sharing that that personal journey where you went from mother to movement leader. I would like to also remind our younger audience, right, that at that time there was no internet or any Facebook groups where you could easily share the information. So it was quite a big step forward. That also shows how patient voice can shape programs and policy. Since the beginning, you've been very intentional about putting patients and families at the very center of this conversation. But how do you make sure that it remains the starting point for every decision?
think patients and families are the starting point. I think that started from a question when I went back to the same physician who diagnosed my sons, and I asked him what research was being done. He was one of my first stops, and he mentioned different institutions where there were efforts in Duchenne, and he mentioned a particular approach, and he said, you know, this might move into something. And I said, could I attend the meeting? And he said, no, because you don't know enough, right? And I said, you know, well, what's next? And he said, well, you'll come see me every 6 months, and then I'll tell you how your sons will be doing, right? And I turned to him and said, you don't need to tell me. 24/7, I know how they're doing. I know how they eat, and I know how they sleep, and I know how they move, and I know how they breathe. So you don't need to give me that information. I need you to get me on a path to go forward. So I think that brings home the fact that patients and families with these catastrophic rare disease diagnoses are the 24/7 constituents about how this disease is going. So without their opinion, I don't think you can do medicine development. Without their opinion, I don't think you should invest in science. I think clinicians need to listen so that we can think together what's going to be best for these patients. So I think if patients aren't at the center of every single step that's moving forward, then you're not taking good steps forward.
Indeed, and as you've said, we families and patients we live this firsthand day in day out with the rare diseases complexities. So we know, and we should have a seat at the table. And I'm hopefully, and I can see that changing now quite a lot in the healthcare ecosystem, where patients are getting more invited to have that conversation, and also to be able to contribute to natural history studies, patient registries, real-world evidence and data, etc. So, in terms of the data that is also a driver of for this change, can you share how PPMD is using patient data to improve care, influence research, and also accelerate the therapies?
Sure. First of all, I just want to clarify. We really have, I know you're talking about having a seat at the table, but I want to say to people who are listening, it's our table. So we invite others to come to that table, right, and join us.
I love
But
that.
I think real world data is really important. If you look at the broad history of medicine, people are given prescriptions every single day and they don't take them. And why don't they take them? Because they don't feel that they're helpful, right? So I think we certainly need scientific data, and we certainly need to understand in medicine's development, what is the target? What is the mechanism of action? How do we get to a dose and do robust clinical trials so that we understand what this drug is doing. We also know in rare diseases that there's considerable variability from patient to patient. So unless we can understand what that real world impact is, how is this patient responding to this particular drug at this particular dose? First of all, you want to take drugs that are effective. There was a criticism long ago that said, you know, patients will take anything. I think that's First of all, that really diminishes the value of patients. They want to take drugs that are safe and effective, but they also don't want to be prevented from taking drugs in a clinical trial that may be effective. So I think this is why we are hand in hand working with therapy development, whether that's in academic institutions or whether that's in companies, because our experience matters, and whether this child can walk longer or live longer or breathe longer. And also, I think it's important to understand in real world data what makes the difference, what's important to the patient. Because, for example, we had an advocacy meeting in 2024. We have them annually in Washington. And one of the young adults said, you know, while you're looking at these outcome measures and hopeful for, you know, a great deal of improvement, at my where I am in this disease process, if you could improve my breathing by 5%, I could go without my ventilator during the day. I could be more social. I could say a complete sentence without needing my ventilator to take a sip. We use sip and puff ventilation. So I think unless you have this real world data of how does it affect the patient and what's important to that patient, then I think people aren't going to access the medicines. They're going to be in that whole realm of write me a prescription, but I won't take the drug. Furthermore, I think what's important is to be able to talk about stability in a rare disease is benefit, right? We always want to look for improvement, but depending on the disease course, staying stable is benefit. And I always say, I don't think there's a parent who goes to bed with a child with a diagnosis that is catastrophic or a rare disease diagnosis that doesn't pray to whatever universe they pray to and say, just stop it here, right? Stop it right here. We'd all like benefit. We'd all like to reverse and go to normal, but stop it right here. So I think the real world evidence is understanding what is important to the patient, understanding that stability is benefit, and understanding that incremental change improves the quality of their lives. And those incremental changes are important and relevant. And I think by collecting that data, then governments or otherwise insurance companies that pay for these drugs can be convinced that they need to cover these drugs because of the relevance for the patient.
You touch upon also what cure means for the rare diseases, right? It's not always necessary the end medicine is how you get there is the journey, and that real world data needs to also be used wisely. So patients and families and carers are actually willing to provide the data rather than being suspicious about how the data is going to be used. I say very frequently that if Facebook or Amazon asks us for any data, we give it straight away. But when we go into insurance or other healthcare institutions, sometimes we are a bit more defensive just because we don't see the tangible value of it. So there's a lot of trust that needs to happen in there as well. And it also means that we need to use data wisely. Speaking of data, Pat, what are the biggest challenges in making sure that patients' data is handled responsibly and actually delivers the impact back to the community?
Well, I think that is a huge question, right? How is data used properly and ethically? So I think that patients are willing, as you said, if Amazon asked us for something that was relevant, we'd give it to them. I think this is where relationships come into play. Relationships with academic centers. When you provide your data to an academic center, I think that there should be an insistence that they share the data with other academic centers, because I think this idea of siloing data is harmful to patients. I think for industry as well, when patients give blood, sweat, and tears and time to participate in clinical trial, that data needs to be available to these patients and their families, because the question is, how did my son or my daughter or the person I love or myself for that matter, how did I respond to this medicine? In what way did I respond to this medicine? So I think, again, sharing data. Also, when we do these natural history studies, natural history is ever evolving in all diseases. So the natural history studies have to be contemporary. So we have to contribute over time, and sharing this data gives us better understanding of the disease, better understanding of our disease, the particular disease that affects an individual. So I think it's the trust of the institutions, and also to read the fine print. I think sometimes as patients, we're very willing to give data and make assumptions that it's going to be shared and that it's going to be in a trusted environment and it's going to be protected. And I think these are questions that we need to ask as patients and families about the data. Where is it going? Who's going to have it? It's in the informed consent, but often the informed consent is 20 or so pages and we're asleep by the end of the time reading it. So I think to be able to say, you show me the important pieces of information that I need to know, so I know these things about sharing data, integrating data, understanding how it's used, and when I will see my own data.
And then to ensure that that data is actually moving from institution to institution and being shared with anonymized measures and all the security,
That's right.
But that everyone can use it, or the allowed people, allowed professionals can use it in a proper way that then brings value back to community. And interoperability is still a big topic, for example, here in Portugal, where I can go to a public health system hospital and I need to tell my story. And if I then go, or my son's story about the rare disease, which is a lot more difficult to tell than my own, and then when I go to another hospital, I still need to tell the entire history because the systems are not connected or talking properly. And that is where the trust is built from.
I agree, Andre. I think that the institutions have an obligation to patients to be interoperable, because to be, first of all, it wastes time to be able to have to tell your story over and over. And I think that this integrating the data gives a much more robust picture of the disease and the disease effect on this individual and how we might utilize it for their good and for the common good of the community.
And this data also allows to turn evidence then into real action points, right? And PPMD has been hugely influential in shaping public policy. You've mentioned some goings to Washington, D.C., for example. How do you go from patient evidence to actually influencing policy, legislation, and even agencies like the FDA?
Well, so, you know what, I think what we don't realize as patients often is that your voice counts, right? And it should count and it needs to count. So long ago, when I met with Dr. Steve Groft at the Office of Rare Diseases, he said the only thing that he could do for us was to have a small meeting. And so we had a small meeting that he brought in to the National Institutes of Health, maybe 20 or so investigators to talk about what do we know? What don't we know? Where's the money? I took notes from that meeting, and how the U.S. government works is that you can think through, right? In all of our states, we have two senators who represent us, and we have several House members. So it's the House and the Senate, and they represent various districts. I think what's important to understand there is we've elected these folks, and I think we should all make ourselves aware is that their rare disease doesn't belong to a political party. This is a bipartisan problem. You know, people on this with every different opinion in the world could have a child with a rare disease. So that matters. So I think taking people to their representatives and establishing relationships, and I don't mean it's just a one-time hello, here's my story. I mean establishing a relationship. And I think for rare diseases, relationships really matter, not only about the individual disease, but the bigger organizations, like in the United States, the Every Life Foundation, Rare Disease Foundations, that we work on a collective agenda, like data sharing. I think this is where we begin to have trust, because long ago, I remember someone said, she's this crazy mom from Ohio. And I said, that's true. I am really a little crazy that my children have Duchenne. But the other side of me is smart, and I can think through what I need to do. So we've created relationships and continue to do that. We've done it on Capitol Hill. So we have very good friends that are in office and continue to be in office. And we go to them and talk to them, not about always an ask. Sometimes it's a thank you, right? Many times it's a thank you. And it's also a recognition that they have a lot of things on their plate. So we don't go with 1,000 requests, we go with a single request. We also go with a consistent request so that if all of our families are going to their representatives, they're saying the same thing in the same words. Because if, for instance, we're asking for money and a group's saying, I want 10 million in research, and another group says 50 million, and another group says 5 million, then the answer is you don't know what you need and why you need it. So getting your messages together in a consistent way and going to those who represent you and telling them why this is necessary, where it would go, and what you think the outcome could be is really important. I have to believe that people in government are there because they want to do something good. And that's the premise I go in, even if we have very different opinions on the rest of the policies in the world. Also, with regard to regulatory, these are also human beings in that regulatory agency. And we went to them long ago and said, we'd like you to understand what it is to live with this disease. And because in a review process, you're looking at numbers, right? You're looking at data and numbers, but you don't know what it feels like. So that led to our interaction with the FDA, and they said, so do preference studies. So do this in a rigorous way so that we understand how you calculate benefit and risk. And we did that. As things changed, and we provided it to them and said, is this sufficient? And if it's not, tell us where it lacks sufficiency. So they came back to us and said, well, we'd like the questions posed a little differently. We said, fine. Right. So I think Andre, it's about that relationship that we have ongoing that says, we're not here to tell you everything. We're here to learn together about how to best serve this community. So that led to many preference studies. In fact, we have a preference study going on now that was in coordination with FDA that looks at stability as benefit so that we can prove in a rigorous way that stability for patients is benefit. We'd all like this word cure, but it's not, depending on where you are in a disease, and maybe for many disease not possible at this moment. So proving stability in a rigorous way is a calculation that is appropriate for our community. So we're doing that. And over time, that led us to say to the FDA, we'd really like you to develop guidance for other people who are developing medicines. And they said to us, we aren't going to do that for every rare disease. Why don't you develop it and send it to us? So we said, okay. I will say, when they said that, I said, okay, we'll do it. And then I walked out the door and thought, oh my goodness, we can't develop guidance. But I think that's the beauty of the advocacy community. We're willing to take on a challenge. And we gave that to the FDA. It turned out to be our first guidance, a 42-page well-referenced document. And it was a community builder. We had basic scientists and physicians and patients and families all together working together to describe Duchenne muscular dystrophy and what you need to know to develop a medicine. We provided it to the FDA, and they were thrilled. And they said, this is great. And they turned around and developed guidance, an eight-page guidance. So I think it's about trust and the premise that people want to do a good thing. So let's have a good relationship and let's try to develop that over time. And then let's think about always with that patient in mind. Are we doing the best we can? If not, what's the question we need to ask and how will we answer that?
And that is so powerful because I still see some patient advocate groups going, asking just in order to get something and with this mindset. But actually we need to co-create value together and build relationships with all these stakeholders. That's the only way forward. I mean, if we want to have that seat at our table, we need to be good hosts to bring others to sit together with us and discuss. So I just love that message, Pat. And talking about leadership and hope for the future, you've been leading this movement for decades now. Looking back, what decisions had the most impact in your long career and journey? And what gives you hope for the future of rare diseases care?
I think the decision to begin, that in the midst of grief, you can do something, right? I also think
that's amazing.
You're going to receive more no's than yeses. And it is very defeating to receive a no, right? And have someone slam the door in your face, but then find another door, right? So I think the decisions, because we had a lot of no's, we still get a lot of no's. And I think then to give back, I can't say enough about thanking people, about being grateful to people. When industry comes in to work on a medicine, to be grateful, also to have parameters, right? Here's what we can do. Here's what we can't do for you. Always protecting the patient. So I think putting a step forward, establishing trust, understanding doors are going to close. And that makes me angry. And I usually take a walk and yell at everybody I know in my head and then come back and say, okay, but what can we do together? I think our decision to start a registry was important. Who are these patients? Our decision to have a meeting. So we had a meeting way back in 1994 after Steve Groff held the one at National Institutes of Health. We got everybody together. I think you need to listen to all the voices. And often there's a voice you don't like to listen to, right? And that might be your most important voice to listen to, because I think you then engage people and you engage trust and you learn. So my best decisions were finding one more person that could listen and work with you. So I found the first yes, and then I figured we would be unstoppable.
No, it's just an amazing but the all the way all your journey. And as a final question, I ask my previous guests to always drop and leave a question to my future guests. So this was coming from one of them. And I think it's a good segue from the previous one. What is not within your reach to change the world, and how could you do it if nothing was impossible?
I think that I struggle because in the United States, we have 8 approvals. We have many, many clinical trials, and most of those trials, or many of those trials, are in the US, EU, and now some in China and Japan. I struggle with South America because there's no infrastructure for reimbursement in many of the countries. But that doesn't, I get it, but I think every child deserves to reach for their dreams. And so, if there were no obstacles, India, South America, Africa, I would like to be able to first genetically characterize these kids because in Africa, we can't even get genetic testing. India, in some areas, is the same. I would like clinical trials. In my world of dreams, I build a bridge. And the bridge is that for now, we are able to bring these patients to the United States. We are able to put them in clinical trials and give them access because I think we have an obligation to care for our children in the best way possible. And when I see people from South America or Africa or other countries saying to me, if only I'd lived there, not that we have magic therapies. We certainly still have considerable unmet need, but we're making progress. And I wish for that progress to be with every child. I wouldn't want to be the parent that says the grass is greener there and it's impossible to reach. So if the world was mine, that statement would be non-existent.
Thank you very much, Pat. And I'll sign for that one because with all the information that we would gather as well, the breakthroughs towards rare diseases and not only would be just amazing. We would not be talking about biased data as we still talk about today. So if I can join you on that dream, count
I would love that.
me in. Thank you for sharing your story, your wisdom, and your vision. Your work reminds us that leadership rooted in empathy, backed by data, and driven by purpose can truly move mountains. And you are showing us that it is possible. And this matters so much, especially for the rare diseases communities that have waited too long to be seen and heard. And we are making the path there, but there's still a long journey to go. Thank you very much for taking your time. To everyone that is listening to us, thank you also for joining us. Don't forget to subscribe and stay tuned for more conversations that put patients and progress at the center of everything we do.